Great. Off we go. All right. So Genesis 12 to 15 is basically the call of Abraham, and we've at least been looking at those things for our own through the sermons for the past several weeks. These chapters, if you're looking, you're on page, I don't know what page you're on actually, but you're at section 2.3, and these chapters introduce, in many ways, they introduce to us God's covenant, even though that is merely an introduction of us to God's covenant. Once we are introduced, we realize this covenant has actually existed since Adam and Eve. But here, in this section, we kind of see, we can see very specific. It's no longer just an implicit covenant, but it's very explicitly stated, God's covenant. And so we look at this, we see God's working in a very special way to bring into existence a people for himself, which is the second of the unifying threads, if you remember, creating or calling a people to himself. And we see that very much focused in the life of Abraham. So as we look, as we consider chapters 12 to 15, you know, you've got chapter 12 that looks at the call, the original call of Abram from Ur to come to that, to the place that God would show him. We see in the end of chapter 12, Abram's his faithless actions in going to Egypt. In chapter 13, we've got the portion telling us about when Abram and Lot separated. Chapter 14 is when Abram goes and rescues Lot. And then chapter 15, which we'll be looking at today in worship, is God's very explicitly spelling out for Abram his covenant. And so as we look at these things, as we consider these things, if you've read through any of these chapters or you can even recall some of the parts of them, what do you see in here on the unifying threads of Scripture? Those being, again, the glory of God, God's calling or creating a people for himself, and God's plan of redemption for that people. Do you see one, two, or all of those threads in these chapters? And if so, where?
Right off the bat, verse 2 of chapter 12, you see the second of those, God calling his people.
Mm-hmm.
I will make you a great nation, I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing, and so forth.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you've got God's calling or creating a people for himself there. Even in the end of it, you have a glimpse of the third unifying thread, where God says, all families on earth will be blessed by you or through you. And so there's something that's going on beyond just that, that there's a blessing that will be brought to earth by this, by God's calling of these people. Other sections or other things that you see of pictures of these unifying threads.
I mean, he calls a man out of idolatry and into and chooses to show grace to him.
Yeah, even that's a picture of God's plan of redemption. That and if you remember last week here, it ought to strike each of us as significant that we find out, unbeknownst to us or even to Abram, right in Palestine, there were people worshiping God, because there's a king of Salem who is a priest of the Most High God, and God doesn't call them for his plan of calling a people to himself. He calls Abram out of Ur, and it's God's mercy is amazing in seeing that. That God doesn't just stay in-house with his mercy, that he goes to the idolaters. He goes to those outside. Even his call of Abraham, then, is a picture of God's blessing the nations. What about God's glory? Do we see pictures of God's glory in these things? What does Abram do as he wanders throughout the the land.
He builds altars
and worships God. Yeah, and again, the worship of God has from the beginning of creation on, the worship of God is all about bringing glory to God. It's about giving God the glory that is due His name. So we see these things in these pictures. Some of this should be reviewed just because we've talked about it so recently in the sermons. But in Genesis 12, 1 to 3, how many promises do you see that God makes to Abram, and what are they?
I counted about four.
You counted four? Anyone else?
He will make us a great nation.
He will make you a great nation. Mm-hmm. What else do you see? So he'll make you a great nation.
Give you the land.
Give him a land.
Bless him and give him a great name.
Make his name great. Mm-hmm. He will bless him. Yeah.
And bless those who bless him.
Bless those who bless him. Curse those who curse him.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on how you count it, you can get to 6, 7, 4. You can say 8. So you've got, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. You will be a blessing to others. I mean, that's a promise that you'll be a blessing to others. I'll bless any who bless you and curse any who curse you. You could take that all as one, or you could separate those. I'll bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you. I mean, that's an amazing thing that God would do even right there. We are called to go to God and make God's friends our friends and God's enemies our enemies. That's what we're called to as God's children. And here God is saying to Abram the exact opposite of that. I will, you know, your friends will be my friends. Your enemies I will consider my enemies. What an amazing graciousness of God to state that. Yes?
In a somewhat negative sense in chapter 15, in verse 13, he says, the Lord said to Abram, know for certain your offspring will be sojourners in a land not theirs. There will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. And in a sense, he's saying, you know what? This is going to happen. And I'll bring judgment on the nation they serve and so on. But you know, it's maybe it's not exactly a promise, but it's, you know, he's definitely telling them their future.
Absolutely. Yeah, chapter 15
I guess
definitely.
Is a promise. It's just not positive to their benefit promise, right?
Well, it's it doesn't sound like a positive to their benefit. I mean, because it's not what any of us would want. But the fact that he's saying, he's just simply telling him, this is what's going to happen. But the promise is, I'm going to be with you. You know, just so you know, and so you can prepare future generations, bad things are going to happen to you. That doesn't mean I've forgotten my promises. In fact, I will punish the people who do these bad things to you. I'll take care of it. And so it's, in one sense, it's just saying, look, my promise of blessing on you isn't necessarily what you think my promise of blessing should be if you were to arrange it. But don't, you need to understand that doesn't need to be reason to doubt. I will take care of this. Yeah.
But you go back to 15:1. I am your shield. I am your great reward.
Yes.
That is a promise.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's an amazing gift. And the thing is that especially reading it and hearing it with Western eyes and ears, we often think that God saying, I am your shield, means no bad thing is going to happen to me then. Life will be easy if I follow God. And worse than our wondering about that is, so how many churches are actually selling that today? Saying to people, if you follow God, your life will be easier. things will get good. You'll get what you're, you know, the name it, claim it. You know, envision the Cadillac. Envision the Cadillac. And
I believe, brother, I believe.
Yeah, and the idea, I mean, you can't read all of Genesis 15 together under that kind of understanding of God. That God starts Isaiah 15 with, "Don't be afraid, I'm your shield," and ends with 400 years of slavery. 400 years. I mean, can you even? I mean, Amy and I have discussed this before when we've considered these things. There were children of God who were born, lived, and died slaves in Egypt. Four generations. They were born, lived, and died slaves in Egypt. Their lives served God's greater purpose of pointing to the gospel in Jesus Christ. And so many times we think of these things in just very theoretical terms. You know, yes, you know, see, there's a, oh, I'm wandering and I'm a slave in Egypt too. And to realize that there were real people who their entire life existed in that state of slavery. That boggles the mind. And yet, that
the whole
doesn't...
history of our nation's only 200 some odd years old.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So,
yeah.
I mean, as Americans, I mean, you know, we think something's old if we can, you know, trace back to the Civil War.
Right.
Around here, maybe the Revolutionary War. But, I mean, it's like double the history of our nation. And
what is the saying that they say? In England, they think 100 miles is a long distance. In America, we think 100 years is a long time. I mean, you got bed and breakfasts in England that are older than our entire country. That kind of boggles the mind.
One time, Stephanie and I were there, and we were touring in one of the countrysides, and we went inside a church, and in the very center of it, you know, because they had expanded the structure or it burned or whatever, but there was like the very middle of the church dated back to William the Conqueror in the 12th century.
It's insane. I mean, my dad has been to England on business, and the hotel he stayed in for business was older than our country. And that's just kind of like that. And we, you know, you can imagine what Rome would look like if they had the philosophy that Americans have toward our structures. It's kind of like, what, 10 years old? Let's burn it. Tear it down. That is decrepit. We need a new stadium. The Colosseum would be gone.
A Scottish man that sold homeowners insurance at a party at someone's house. And he looked around his house and goes, you couldn't get insurance on this house in Scotland. He goes, my walls are like a yard thick of stone in this house. You know, I give this house 70 years and it'll fall down. You know, it's just such a different frame of reference.
Yeah, I mean, it's scary even. The way homes... This is a tangent. Never mind. Let's just move on. That's right. Where's our rat hole? Rabbit track trail. Anyway. Well, as we follow Abram in this section, what do we learn about the kind of people that God chooses to be his?
Undeserving.
Why do you say that, Rick? I mean, maybe you feel that way.
You and I, you need to buy me lunch. What you look at right after, right in 13?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the end of 12.
End of 12. And
yeah.
God has made all these promises, fresh, brand new promises. And
mm-hmm.
He seems to think he needs others' protection besides.
Yeah, not just there, but I mean, chapter 15 is this huge. I mean, and I hate to give away too much from the sermon, but I mean, chapter 15 is an enormous chapter of God's promises, and then to be followed up with chapter 16 of Hagar and the birth of Ishmael. That is amazing. Yes.
What I see here in the end of 12 is, even though the promised are already in the 15, he's already kind of doing what he has promised.
Mm-hmm.
So he's protecting Sarah from the lie.
You don't like my... It's entertaining, at least. Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
He's protecting Sarah instead of the lie that Abraham and the lack of faith that Abraham had.
Yeah.
So that's part of the accomplishment of the promise of the Lord.
That's exactly right. And you know, chapter 15 is the, or 16 is the second time in Scripture that that husbands are chastised for listening to their wives. That was a little freebie there for you. Just do whatever you want with that one. I'll need you to buy me lunch. I'll need you to buy me supper also that day. So we follow Abram. All right, we already talked about that. What does God provide for Abram to keep him from ruining the very thing God is working to create?
Say God protects him, preserves him, and prospers.
It's not to say that God's that there wasn't a physical blessing that Abram received. His household did grow and prosper under the hand of God. There's definitely a constant protection of Abram's household, often in spite of Abram's lack of faith and Abram's actions.
I think that Sarah could have just killed him for lying to him that way.
Yes. Yeah. Very much so.
God gives him a covenant.
Mm-hmm.
A covenant promise that's meant to protect him from sort of looking to this world for his reward.
He not only gives him the promise, then he promises to fulfill the covenant himself.
Right. God takes on himself all responsibilities for the fulfillment of this promise.
Genesis that Abraham was like asleep or something when God did that. You know, when he walked through the,
mm-hmm.
the
carcasses.
Yeah, but what was the thing? What moved through the middle of it? It was like
the smoking pot and the fire, and the torch.
I mean, you almost got the sense that Abraham had like, okay, that was done, and then kind of like almost in the middle of the night, God did that.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did he do it all, but it's like Abraham wasn't involved in any way.
Right.
I don't know if that's true, but that's at least the impression I got from reading.
That's the. I think that's a proper impression, and the picture ought to be. It ought to overwhelm us. I mean, that's the picture in Genesis 15, especially the end, is God. God basically brings this covenant, this ceremony of ratifying a covenant, and Abram knows exactly what God is doing. It's always been strange to see, God asks for these animals, and that's all we hear. God asks, bring me this, 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 and this. And Abram goes and gets them, slices every mammal in half and lays it out, kills the birds and lays them at the end of the aisle. Is the writer just saving ink? Is he just not telling us that God gave very detailed instructions to Abraham on what to do with the animals? No, it's that Abram knew what God wanted. Abram recognized immediately from the ingredients that were asked for what God was doing. He knew that there was a covenantal ceremony that was about to take place, because Abram has asked two times, how can I know? How can you bless me? What can you give me? You haven't given me any children. How can I know this is your plan, that you're going to do these things? And God's answer is, bring me these things. Abram says, how can I know? God says, bring me this stuff. So Abram knows what is about to transpire. And so and I'll be talking much more about it in the sermon, but this is a ceremony of basically ratifying a covenant. Covenant, you know, in the simplest terms, is simply an agreement. You can have a covenant between equal parties, like a marriage covenant. You can have a covenant between a ruler and his subjects. And then separate from that, you can have a covenant that is bilateral, which means that there are equal responsibilities on both sides of both following through with these things. There's equal responsibilities of receiving blessing from the other. And then as a result of that, equal responsibilities for the consequence of the breaking of that covenant or that agreement. And then there's also unilateral covenants where the covenant agreement is very much one-sided. The amazing thing that we see in this ratification of this covenant is that it is a ceremony that normally applies to a bilateral covenant where both parties will come together and will say, okay, this is what I agree to, this is what you agree to, and then these two parties walk together down this aisle of these carcasses, and what they are saying as they walk down the aisle is essentially, let the fate of these animals lie on me if I ever break this covenant. I accept that if I break this covenant, this death that these animals have experienced, I deserve. And I will have broken the covenant to the level that these animals have been severed in half. And so the amazing, you're exactly right in noticing it, Robert, because that's then crazy that Abram turns from participant to witness of this covenant. Abram is set aside, a deep darkness comes on him, and this smoking pot and burning torch proceed alone through down the aisle of these carcasses.
Do those two things have any meaning?
They do. Where else have we seen these images of a smoking pot or a smoke and fire type image?
Are we thinking of the cloud by day and the fire by night?
Yeah.
Darkness?
Yeah, consider this is exactly what the people are experiencing the presence of God to be right now as when Moses first tells them about their father Abram. They are experiencing that God's presence is a pillar of smoke in the day and a pillar of fire at night. At Mount Sinai, the smoke that comes down and envelops the mountain and the fire that is there, the lightning and the fire. At the tabernacle, when the smoke of God, it fills the tabernacle with his presence when he's there. These images of these things specifically indicate God's presence. They would have gasped over every aspect of this recounting of what happened between Abram and the Lord. That the fire and cloud that represented the very presence of God alone goes through these carcasses. I mean, what are the two? See, this is horrible. You guys can all volunteer in the nursery today.
No, it's good. We need to hear these things 3 or 4 times. So I don't want to see anything.
Do you?
Oh, yes.
That's right. That's right. Any of you that are going to care group, yeah, you get it 3 times this week. What's the significance of this, though? There are at least 2 things that you should that ought to make you go, wow.
Well, I think it's an amazing condescension of God to give that additional assurance to Abraham. And Hebrews 6 sort of unpacks that a little bit where it talks about the promises of God being on the basis of 2 things that cannot lie. I mean, God had already promised Abraham these things to become a great nation.
Right.
And God cannot lie, but the amazing thing about the way that God deals with man is he recognizes his frame and his weakness.
Yes.
And so he gives the additional thing where he promises by himself and acts as a witness to himself and says, in essence, I know I've already told you this, but now I'm going to confirm this by this ceremony. And if truth be told, we could probably just, if we were spiritual enough, just say God has said it, therefore. But God is such that He gives us visible and historical events that break into our lives that mm-hmm. say, this, I promise, will come to pass, or this is what will happen. And we say, well, it's impossible for God's nature to be torn asunder, so He has to fulfill this. And that's
yes.
exactly the point that's being made, is that God, if God were to not cause this to happen, His very nature would be torn asunder.
Yes. So that's the first thing that should amaze us, is that here's a covenant agreement that is supposed to be between two parties, so that the fulfillment of this agreement is equally a burden between both parties. Both parties are under the burden to make sure this happens. And here God is saying, the fulfillment of this covenant rests entirely on me. You cannot, nothing you do will break this covenant.
So it kind of says, Abram, cut these things in half and sit over here on this rock and watch what I'm about to do.
Right, right. And so both the gift of the ceremony, which you're right, I mean, we ought, if we had perfect faith, we wouldn't need any of these. But we don't want to bemoan that we don't. God designs us in that way. And, I mean, whether it's a result of the fall or it was even in the garden. I mean, you see that. I mean, the tree of life was almost a sacramental representation, reminding God's people that He was with them. And so then throughout the fall, at every step, God recognizes our frailness. He recognizes we need these signs. We need these pictures. Rich, you and I were talking about even Communion Sunday, how it feels like. You know, a lot of times folks take more time over the weekend on a Communion Sunday to prepare their hearts. There's more effort in just kind of meditation and just a recognition that this is a very sacred activity, this communion we get to do. And Rich even said, I should probably have that feeling toward every Sunday. And that's true. But we should probably have that feeling toward every day. Every day we should look at and say, I need to prepare my heart for this day. Here is the vocation God has called me to. Here are the activities God has ordained for me to do. There are people that I'm going to come in contact with that are opportunities that God has instructed me. Make the most of every opportunity that you have. What am I doing to prepare myself for each day? Well, even recognizing that, God gives us one day in seven to prepare ourselves even more to meet with God. And He gives us these communion Sundays and baptisms that are even more an opportunity to prepare ourselves and to see God's presence and to experience it in a deeper, tangible way. Our physical beings is not a design flaw. God designed us physically, and then in His mercy shows Himself to us physically. We get to touch and taste the bread and wine and remember the actual real presence of Jesus Christ. We get to see the water poured out. We get to see a child's dripping head and the picture of God's abiding presence there, the washing, just everything that shows, even in circumcision, which will be coming up in a couple chapters, just that picture of God's cutting away, God's very intentional removal of sin from us. All of these tangible aspects of what God is doing for us. And there are times that we can wonder, well, why am I so weak? Why do I need that? We don't need to worry about why we need it. We need to be amazed that God has said, I give it to you. What an amazing God that here's Abraham, saying, how can I know? And if any of us were God at that moment, we'd smack him on the head and say, Did I not just say? What do you mean? How can you know? I mean, our kids, that frustrates us to no ends with our kids. If you constantly are telling your kids that you're going to do something and they keep saying, yeah, but how do I know? How can I know that that's really going to happen? So how about this? How about I just smack you and send you to your room and it just doesn't happen now, you ungrateful little wretch. There you go. And yet here is Abram saying, how can I know, though? And God's gracious response of saying, let me show you how you can know. This is how you can know. Nothing he promises is anything larger than what he's already promised him. He simply now gives a sign to say, this is how you can know. It's amazing.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So is there evidence, you've stated that Abram knew exactly what was about to happen by what he was called by God to bring and what to do with those animals. Is there, do we have evidence that this was already part of the culture, that people were cutting animals in half and walking between them and so on?
We do. A lot of it's extra-biblical evidence that this was a very standard means of ratifying a covenant or an agreement. There's also...
I'm just wondering if literally if someone broke a covenant, they'd be okay, cut me in half.
It did mean death.
Right.
It meant death.
That's something that's key here. The blood, these covenants were never, these ceremonies were never performed without blood. I mean, the idea, the Hebrew of covenant is cutting a covenant. So blood is, for the people of the time, that just was natural. That they understood that completely, that this meant blood.
And to have
God do this, the only way it can be fulfilled, because we broke the covenant over and over and over again, the only way it could be filled was by blood, and by God's blood. So.
Yeah, I think the other thing, too, is that it's helpful to understand the covenant framework in here, even in the fact that Abraham's driving away the birds of the air, because there's a lot of motifs here that if you're not paying attention, you're going to, some people create radical discontinuity and say that what Moses is doing is new, but essentially what it is an expansion of the same idea of the motif of cursings from the birds of the earth and those sorts of things. And so this is really the first time that God, he's already established a relationship, but he's actually confirming that relationship in the cutting of a covenant. And I agree with Rick. The idea of life being tied up in the covenant is very key to understanding. We're bound in our life to God through this, and he's promised his life that he would make it come to pass.
Yes. There's another, and I'm sorry I didn't write it down, but there's a passage in Jeremiah that uses this language of your prophets, your priests, have walked through the divided animals before me. There's language of talking about when Israel cut a covenant with when the Lord cut a covenant with Israel, and that's the other indicator of it, is that the Hebrew language for making a covenant is literally to cut a covenant, and so it's a very visual picture then of that, what happens when a covenant is made. If one of you has a more extensive concordance than I do, you might, for the sake of all of us, look up, try to find something. It's somewhere in Jeremiah.
Jeremiah
34:18,
maybe?
Maybe so. 34:18. That might be it, because I was looking at 24 and I couldn't find it.
Seems like with gloss most of that today, we just spill lots of ink and then argue over what we really meant.
Yeah. It's there. And the men who transgressed my covenant and did not keep the terms of the covenant that they made before me, I will make them like the calf that they cut in two and pass between its parts.
And so even as much later as Jeremiah, they knew what these covenantal proceedings were about. There's other places where it talks about the whole nation walking through. There's a picture of it in the Red Sea, this dividing and walking through. But even more than that, at the ratification of the law, when Abram dips the hyssop branch in ashes and blood and sprinkles the entire nation. It was a way of ratifying a covenant for an entire huge group of people that could not possibly send, you know, even hundreds of thousands, let alone millions, through a carcass aisle. You could baptize them with the ashes and blood, and again indicating let the fate of these things fall on me if I would break this covenant. And one of you brought it up while we were looking this up, is the second amazing truth of this, that God says, I will die to keep this covenant. He's not only saying, this covenant is so sure that it depends entirely on me. He also says, if this covenant is broken, I will take the death on myself. And the covenant is broken. We do break the covenant. All of us have broken God's covenant. And God, right there with Abram, gives a picture of the cross of Jesus Christ. And he says, I will die. I will take this death on myself in order to keep this covenant. It's an amazing, amazing truth that death is required. Blood is required for the breaking of a covenant. And God says, it will be my blood. I will do this. Both of those truths would have overwhelmed Abram and the people of God later on, hearing about this. Now, whether the second truth would be as clear before Christ came is unclear for us, because it's hard, you know, just like it's hard for us to think through what would pre-fall thinking look like, it's hard for us to think through what does pre-Christ understanding of God's deliverance look like. Because at the very least, God's people would see the first promise. The keeping of this covenant is entirely based on God's ability to keep it. And we know he can keep it because we know that God's promises are true.
Where does God say that he will die to keep the covenant?
He doesn't say it. It's just that's the implication of this covenant ceremony. That these two parties are walking through, they are saying, I will die if this covenant is broken. And the covenant is broken, and God does die. But he doesn't die to end the covenant. He dies to actually fulfill the covenant.
Does Abraham walk through the carcass?
He doesn't.
God does, right?
Only God.
In the smoke and the fire, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can I read Hebrews 6:13?
Yes.
For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, surely I will bless you and multiply you. And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. For people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all their disputes, an oath is final for confirmation. So when God desired to show more convincingly the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope set before us. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor to the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain where Jesus Christ has gone.
It's kind of ominous to me that I don't know if there's any real connection here, but as we were talking about this, I thought of the Jews that were shouting in the crowd as Jesus was dying on the cross and paying that penalty. You know, let his blood be on us and our children's children and so on. And then the thought of how national Israel, just three decades later, was destroyed in the fall of Rome and was cut up and separated and cast out of their lands and so on.
Yeah. Yes.
Almost seems like, even in our pride, we want to be the ones that can somehow take on this burden and fulfill this role and let his blood be on us. I mean, clearly they didn't understand what the cross was all about, but
Paul wishes that he could do that for his own countrymen too, and wishes that he could die, but realizes he's not fit.
Right.
The right sacrifice.
But so far as Christ intended, I mean, he did pray for those who taunted him on the cross, and I think Acts 2 can't be completely understood until you see the people who had probably shouted for Christ's crucifixion saying, what must we do, with the realization that this is the man that they shouted to be put to death, and that Paul, in that one of Peter's responses is that be baptized, and this promise is for you and your children. So in one sense, there's a recognition that this Christ has come to take away that curse, even that you've called upon yourselves.
Hmm. Yes. I know this will seem strange, but I think we can actually get through the birth of Isaac in these next 5 minutes. Because that's all that section 4 is about, is Isaac and the passing on of the promise to Isaac. How does the birth of Isaac represent sort of a down payment by God on the promises that he made to Abraham? Mm-hmm. Yeah, God has gotten clearer and clearer and clearer every time. When God says, I'm going to bless you and make you a great nation. Abram says, all right, so what? By Eleazar, my purchased servant, this dude that was born in my house, but isn't my son. That's how you're going to bless my nation. He says, no, straight from your own loins, he says. And so then the very next thing is, it seems like at almost every point, Abram's like, okay, how's he going to do that? I know, you're going to do the slave thing. Yeah. Right. And God's like, no, it'll come straight from your own loins. So then Abram's like, okay, how's he going to do? Oh, I know, I'm going to sleep with Hagar. And then that comes from my own loins. And that's it. And God's like, no, that's not it. And here is Isaac born to Abraham and his wife. God blesses both Abraham and Sarah with a son, and it's exactly what Rick said. It's basically saying, I told you. Now, if I can give you 100-year-old Abraham, 99-year-old Sarah, a son, I mean, are there any of my promises now that you need to doubt? And so it's very much a down payment. It's specifically a down payment on the promise, especially the promise that's given to Eve and Adam, repeated to Noah, and repeated to Abraham, that your offspring, this is through your offspring, your seed will provide your salvation.
In Romans 4, even unpacks this in relation to the gospel in terms of underlining that essentially out of death, the Lord brought life.
Mm-hmm.
Almost as a picture of resurrection that somehow God is able to make. I mean, it just seems absurd if you ever, I mean, obviously we know people that are really old to think of an 100-year-old person having a child with that age. I mean, but that's God performing his promise again unconditionally and unilaterally.
Yes. Can you see, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's so like.
That's right.
I mean, it wouldn't make sense for him to like wait until she's like 45 or 50. I mean, that's really old, but, still, I mean, it's not like totally old.
It's doable, yeah.
I can kind of understand that. No, God waits until there's like, he waits until there's no hope.
Yeah.
But at that time,
they're
90 years old, or like 45
now? I don't think so. I don't think it would have been like that, because even the New Testament says he as good as dead. Even Sarah, when God reiterates the promise, Sarah, her language practically indicates this will almost be a virgin birth, because she says, "Am I to enjoy the pleasure of my husband at this age?" So indicating that, they truly are 99 and 100. in every sense that you might think a 99 and 100-year-old husband and wife might interact together, they're there. That's where they are. There's definitely... Now, I mean, because... And it's because, you know, however God did it, whether it was very naturally through the post-diluvian, post-flood natural world that man started dying earlier, or whether it was simply specifically by God's statement, 120 years now. That's the most they get when he says that in Genesis 6. There is a dropping off of age from, even you see it in that the 10 generations from Noah to Abraham. There's a shortening of life that happens such that, you know, even Abraham doesn't live much beyond 100, 120. Moses lives to 120. Moses even in Psalm 90 says, you know what, 70, 80 if you're strong. And so, by the time we get to Abraham, just by the language that we see between Abraham and Sarah and their interactions with this promise, 99 really is pretty close to what 99 is today. Now, certainly it's not entirely. They definitely had more strength back then. 75 years old, and he takes a 400-mile journey from Ur to a land he has no idea of. They're certainly in better shape and healthier than we are today at these ages, but their internal biological clocks are rusty.
I just mentioned that because I heard that the calendar years were shorter, instead of like 12 months and like 8 months or something.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll stop here, but part of the reason people describe things in those ways is the difficulty we have with the supernatural. We describe years, we think they had to have been this because there's just no way. Well, there is a way. We just don't know it. When we get to Exodus and the 10 plagues on Egypt, there are those who give a very convincing scientific description of how all of these things could have very naturally happened. Now, is that possible that that's how God did it? Sure, it's possible, but it's not necessary. People do that because they can't accept a supernatural intervention type.
Another example would be Jonah and the fish. You know, it says God prepared a fish. You don't need to look for a specific species of whale that might have a large enough bladder of air in its stomach or whatever.
Right.
It says God prepared a fish, and that may mean one unique creature that was able to do that because God can do those things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that that's necessarily how it happened, but it's certainly in the realm of the options.
It was Monstro.
Right.
Jonah fish.
Is anyone? Come on. Now that was, we get the front end and back end movie quotes. The whale in Pinocchio, Monstro. You didn't know that was his name. See, that's what I'm here for. Teach you guys the things you don't know. Huh? Maestro? All right. Let's pray.